Welcome to the Medical Narratives Podcast with your host, Dr. Michael Gordon. I'm Regina Starr, and today we have a special episode with Dr. Gordon to talk about his new book, Medical Findings, My 60-Year Journey. The readers of Health Plexus and Dr. Gordon's colleagues know how much he loves to write and share stories. He has already published several books, including Looking Through the Lens, Brooklyn Beginnings, Parenting Your Parents, and Late Stage Dementia. Hi, Michael. Good to see you.
Hi. Good to see you.
Why did you choose to write another book with the title Medical Findings?
Well, as you said, I love to write and I love to tell stories. In fact, I would say one of the reasons I love medicine, especially geriatrics, is because it's full of stories. Every clinic I have, I say I could write an article because there's a story. And as I think I end one article I wrote, Jimmy Durante used to say when they asked him about his jokes, he says, I got a million of them. So I have a million stories. So I thought, although I've written other articles and books about stories, I thought I would write one that focused primarily on my medical experiences. And in medicine, we often say, we use the term medical findings. In other words, those are the clinical discoveries or experiences that mold what we do in medicine. And since it is just about 60 years, I thought that would be a nice title, Medical Findings, My 60 Years Experience. So once I got it into my head, I thought I will do it in a linear fashion, and I would really start, I'll say, at the pre-beginning. In other words, how I ended up choosing medicine, deciding to change my focus from engineering to medicine, why I decided to study medicine overseas rather than in the United States, and how, because I studied overseas in Scotland, I had the opportunity to travel all over Europe and some of the Middle East, and including Eastern Europe. And in each place, I had medical experiences that had stories. And then when I finished all my travels and studying, my formal studying, I ended up coming back through various directions and changes of ideas and opportunities. I ended up in Toronto. And I used it somewhere in the book. I quote my late grandmother who helped raise me. She was from Lithuania. And she used to say, there's always another bus. It may not be going exactly where you want to go, but it's going somewhere. And in some ways, my life has been a series of changing buses, not knowing always where they were going. But at the end, I found myself in a place that I was happy to be.
Beautiful. Nothing like the wisdom from our grandparents.
Right.
So who do you think this book will appeal to?
Well, I've already got some feedback because I sent it out to some people to look at it. Some people wrote very nice comments about it. I thought it would appeal to, first of all, people interested in the possibility of studying medicine. And that's because usually when people said they want to be doctors, they're thinking of either their beneficence, they want to do good, or they've had an experience in their lives often that stimulated them to want to be doctors, often an illness in the family, and they witnessed what happened. Or they have socioeconomic reasons because they know it's a good profession, they know they'll make a good living. Or, as in the case of many cultures, families sort of encourage, I'll use a mild word, encourage their children to get a profession because socially and economically that's a good thing to do. So when you ask people why do they want to be doctors, they often give you a combination. When they were applying to medical school, they never say, I want to be a doctor because I want to have a good living and a high standard of living and live in a nice neighborhood and have a Tesla. They always say, I've read many applications to medical school. I have a desire to do good. And that at the end of their training, they end up doing something in medicine that, although it may be doing good, certainly, the socioeconomic attraction is very great. And I can remember during the doctor's strike some years ago, a physician I knew who was very upset because the extra billing interfered with his income. And I knew from various data that his income was in excess of $1 million a year. Now, I don't begrudge people making money. We all like to make money, but comfortable. I can't imagine what I would do if I made $1 million a year, because I don't even know if I would buy a better car, because the car I have, which is 12 years old, that's what it's supposed to do. It goes from A to B, it's comfortable, and it has a nice music system. So why people choose medicine, I don't know. But I thought for somebody who might be interested, and if my storytelling is good and effective, they might read a book like this and say, you know what? This is what I want to do. So that's one. The second group would be people who already are in their training in medical school, or especially their postgraduate training, who have an interest in communicating to others. And reading a book that does that might stimulate them to do it themselves. I often encourage my trainees, and I say to them, do you like to write? And for those that say yes, I say, look, if you like to write, I will be happy to help you. And I often, in fact, use our platform, Health Plexus, to give them the opportunity to write. And I say to them, whatever their level is, you will be the first author, and I will make sure that I can help you write a proper article that will get published and have actually a wide distribution. It's an online journal, but it'll give you the feeling of what it's like to be published. And I can tell you, for those of us who've been writers, there is nothing that is as exciting and satisfying when you're doing all this clinical work and you're saving lives is to see something in print that you wrote. So that's one group. The next group is doctors. So doctors often want to have a, in a sense, a verification of why they're doing what they're doing. And I know from my own experience, if I read something that resonates with my own experience, it makes me feel good. So for example, of the great writers contemporary literature, one of them who I love is Abraham Verghese, who wrote the book Cutting for Stone. It's a brilliant book, and I've also heard TED Talks. So in that particular book, he's in, I'm trying to think where he is. I think he's in East Africa. He quotes a visiting professor that came to evaluate his medical school. And who was this professor? Professor Ian Hill. Who was Professor Ian Hill? My professor of medicine in Dundee, Scotland. Well, I remember I was reading this while I was on a treadmill, because I often read while I'm exercising, and I almost fell off the treadmill. I was so excited because that little passage resonated with me. And the last group is people who like to read for entertainment. For whatever reason, people like to read medical stories. It's a very popular genre. Some people like to read mysteries. Some people like to read love stories. Some people like to read science fiction. Some people like to read sci-fi. So people like to read things that they find enjoyable. Some people like, and when I'm seeing in my clinic and I speak to everybody, I ask them as part of an assessment of their cognition, are you still reading? And they say, yes. I said, so what are you reading? Now, sometimes people who have problems with their cognition, they're really not reading. What they're talking about is what they used to read. And, you know, the family members sitting there and they're sort of rolling their eyes and they say, so what are you reading? Well, I used to read. And they tell me what they used to read. So what are you reading now? And often they're not, although sometimes they are. And then the question is, when you read a book and you put it down and you pick it up, do you remember what you were reading? And sometimes they say, no. I have to go back a chapter and read it, but I'm still reading. So reading is a very important part of most people's lives. And some people like to read biographies. There's a big, big market for biographies. Everybody who's ever been anybody writes a biography. There's histories and there's memoirs. Memoirs not write a biography. And it's interesting because a lot of people don't understand. And there was a case, it became a legal case some years ago, where somebody wrote a book and it was marketed as a memoir. And one of the well-known television personality reviewers criticized the author because something in the memoir wasn't accurate. And it was interesting because it ended up resulting in a kind of back and forth letters. And a memoir is not an autobiography, which supposedly is accurate as can be, you know, research. A memoir is as I remember the situation. And I remember writing some of my memoirs where my sister would say, Michael, that's not what happened. It wasn't your cousin Leslie, it was your cousin Heidi. And I said, it doesn't matter. It was my cousin. I mean, for the reader, the important thing is this was somebody with whom I had a relationship. So that's for the why people read it. And I hope that as many people who are interested read it. Yesterday, I was on a Zoom call with a classmate of mine. Now, we studied in Dundee. She is a mixture of Scottish and English. So she decided to go to St. Andrews. And we spent four years in the same class. And she ended up emigrating to Canada for various reasons. And we've been in touch. We used to go to reunions. And I wanted to connect with her because I haven't seen her because the reunions were all canceled because of COVID. So we did a nice little catch up. And she had just bought my book. Now, she read it. She said, what I enjoyed about it, because it brought back all my memories. Because when you're writing about medical school, Dundee, they were my memories as well. And we joked about how she perceived me in the first year of medical school. So you have to understand, I grew up in New York, in an environment where when you went to school, you want to be noticed, right? If somebody said anything, you raised your hand. In Scotland, the rule was, you didn't want to be noticed. You wanted to get through medical school without anybody knowing you, because if they knew you, then they might find something out about you. So she said, I read this and I laughed to myself because I remember my first impression of you in our first class of anatomy where you raised your hand. Nobody raises their hand in a lecture in Scotland. And I didn't realize that, but I heard the floor shuffling. And that was my classmates basically expressing a discomfort. And after the class, one of my friends who I befriended very early, who was one of the local Scottish boys, said, Michael, you don't raise your hand in class, ever. And I said, what? Well, how do you ask a question? And he said, you don't. So that was somebody who read the book because it brought back memories. So that's the audience.
Nice. And then someone like me is just a huge fan. Who is your publisher and why did you choose that publisher?
Now, it's sort of interesting. The publishing industry is a very interesting industry and it's evolved greatly. So when I wrote my first book, which is called Old Enough to Feel Better, A Medical Guide for Seniors, and this was before the internet and social media. So I wrote 30 letters, having gone through some kind of tome that listed publishers potentially available, right? And it was all typed on a regular typewriter with my fingers to all these 30 publishers, trying to interest them in my book. So of the 30 publishers I wrote to, I got 29 rejections. Now, most people in their life have had a rejection or two or three. And it's often in the realm of romance. And everybody knows if you're rejected by a romantic interest, it's hurtful. I remember when I was rejected having applied to Columbia University. Now, I kind of thought Columbia was out of my league, certainly socioeconomically, but not intellectually. But I was rejected and I felt bad, but it didn't matter that much because the fact is, I probably had better options for me and in my world, which I did. I ended up going to my local Brooklyn College, which was a fabulous and free, as opposed to Columbia, liberal arts college. Anyway, the original publishers were all full service publishers. If they wanted your book, they sent you a contract which basically said, you will present to me, deliver to me a pair of 800, 600, 400 pages, words, you know, whatever it is. And if approved, we will give you an advance of $100, $200, $500 against sales, which meant if they gave you $500, you didn't have to give the money back if you sold $500 worth of books. Well, the assumption always was, that's okay. You know, you're going to sell 500 books, but if you didn't, sometimes they'd say, okay, just keep the money. It wasn't a law. Yeah. So I got 29 rejections, and then I got one acceptance. And of course, I was very excited. So again, without the internet and the things, I looked up wherever I could with the data, was there, the publisher. And I found that authors who use that publisher weren't that impressed with it. I had never heard of them, but that doesn't matter. So I decided, I don't think so, and I'll just keep plugging along. And one day I was sitting around, and since it's the day before cell phones, my pager went off. For those who don't remember, a pager was a little gizmo that buzzed or rang, and then you had to make a phone call because the pager gave the phone number, right? I see the number's a 212 number, which I know is New York, because I grew up there. And I call after the rounds, and there's a gentleman who introduced himself as Frank Taylor. And he says, I'm the editor, the acquisition editor of Children Books. And I've read your blurb about your book, and I'm very interested. Can we arrange to meet? Well, I was floored. What I did after that, I looked up Children Books. Now, Children Books was famous for writing automobile repair manuals. And I'm looking at this and, wait, my book is, maybe you made a mistake. My book isn't a automobile repair manuals. I don't even have an automobile. So I called him back. I said, I don't understand. And he said, you're right. But when they hired me, and he had been, as I found out after, a senior editor at some very high-level publishers, he said, Chilton decided to branch out into self-help books. Because in some ways, an automobile repair manual is a self-help book. It's teaching a person to help take care of their car rather than being dependent on a mechanic. And when you think about it, when people read self-help medical books, part of it is not so much to diagnose themselves, but to be knowledgeable when they go to the doctor. And now with internet, I have on a regular basis, people quoting to me, they read on the internet about my decision-making. And I consider it so important that often in the middle of our assessment, if I make a recommendation, I say, for example, to the child or the wife, take out your smartphone and look up the following, and we will read it together. And they, oh, it's usually a drug. And they open it up and they read the drug. I said, so that's why I'm recommending this drug. They said, what about the side effects? I said, scroll down. You're going to see 272 side effects. Now, pick up any other drug and scroll down. You will see 272 side effects. And you'll find that they're all the same side effects, give or take a little. And when you look at side effects, anything that ever occurred in a patient in a study has to be listed. So what I will tell you are the common side effects and the serious side effects. And I explain. So this person says, yes, we're branching out. If you could bring me a manuscript, better than that, send me a manuscript and then we'll meet. So I actually had a secretary where I worked at Baycrest, who was a marvelous secretary, and this was before computers, who had typed out for me on a Selectric IBM typewriter my manuscript, I remember, with three carbon copies. Do you remember carbon copies? You have to be old enough, so I'm not asking you, Regina, how old you are, but if anybody remembers carbon copies, they're more than 40, right? So for those who don't know, these were basically paper that had an ink side that when you hit it with the typewriter, it typed through the ink and you had it on a list. So with very fine copy paper, you could make three or four copies with one type. And this electric, as a particular typewriter, gave a very powerful impact. So I go to New York. Fortunately, my best friend lived in New York, so I had a place to stay. And I go up to this house, which was a brownstone in a very nice neighborhood. And I walk in and I meet Frank. We start talking and he says, "This is a very good book. It's a very good first draft." And I almost fell off my seat. First draft? I thought this is my book. No, it's a wonderful first draft. The only thing is you have to change it from a didactic book to a personal book. Now that I've met you, I know exactly what you have to do. In this version of the book, you talk about they and him and they, and I want you to change it all to you, okay? You, rather than for those who feel headaches, is to change to if you feel a headache. So I had to change the whole book to as if he says, I want you to make believe you are sitting in front of a patient and explaining everything is booked to that patient. Well, in the computer days now, that would be a find and replace. But on this, it was a complete retype. And my wonderful secretary did it within a month. And I sent it to him. And he said, come and see me. And he looked at the, he had the book. He said, this is what I wanted. I am now going to send you a contract. So that's how I found my first publisher. And after that, I went through a number of other books and I found publishers. I have another one that I'm trying to upgrade now called Announce of Prevention, which was published by Prentice Hall Canada, which was a well-known publisher. And old enough to feel better as it went through various iterations, I ended up working with different full-service publishers, Seal, Bantam Press, Key Porter Press in Canada, and then previous last iteration was by the Johns Hopkins University Press, which did a beautiful job. But these are full-service press. You make a contract, you're going to get 8% royalties. Maybe they give you a couple hundred dollars, whatever. And then as I kept writing, and I had an agent for a while, and I wrote to her, and she said, you know what? The publishing industry is getting very, very hard. I don't think you're going to be able to place this book. And one of the people I spoke to at Johns Hopkins University Press, where I wanted to do a revision, she said, I don't think we're going to do it. But you know what you should try? Try one of the hybrid publisher, in which you as the author and the publisher basically split the cost of production. And rather than them printing 1,000 copies, which sit in a warehouse, it's just-in-time publishing. And they recommended a publisher called iUniverse. Well, I logged into iUniverse because by this time we had the computer world and I read what they did and what they charged wasn't onerous. Their royalties were much harder than a full service press. And I said, okay. So my first book with iUniverse was my first memoir, Brooklyn Beginnings. And they did a marvelous job. The cost was very modest. They did editing, they did all kinds of things. And I got to know one of the editors, and we used to speak periodically, and she gave me very good advice. So my second two books I did, that was Late Stage Dementia, also just had a second revision with iUniverse, and Ethical Issues in Elder Care. After I did my Master in Ethics, I wanted to explain to family members how ethical decisions are made, because many of them struggle with it. Now, each one of those books I did with iUniverse, they did a beautiful job. And I've written this last year, or 2 years ago when I couldn't work yet after my illness, I revised each one of them. And because I was already one of their authors, it gave me an even better price for the revisions. In fact, they gave me what I know living in Canada is a hat trick, which they gave me a price for the three of them. They said, if you could revise all three of these and place it with iUniverse, we're going to give you a deal. And they sure did. Well, when I started writing previous to Medical Findings, it was a book that published, but I wanted to publish articles that I had published over a previous, I'd say, 8 or 10 years, including many on Health Plexus, many from the Annals of Long-Term Care and from other places, including a couple of short stories. And I included with it about 40 pictures, many of which I took myself to illustrate the stories. And I can't remember who recommended to me. I think it was my eldest daughter, who's an English professor, who said, why don't you look at Amazon Publishing? You know, Amazon is Amazon. So they have a big publishing arm. And that publishing arm is related to Amazon and Kindle. So all of their books automatically become available on Kindle, which is their, you know, e-reader, and advertised on Amazon. All the other books are advertised on Amazon. So I thought, I'll give them a shot. Well, and also the price was not exorbitant. It was reasonable. Well, they did a fabulous job. Pictures, everything. Cover, they designed the cover. I had a fabulous managing editor who we went back and forth, and it came out, and it really, I'm very proud of that book. It's lovely. So when I decided to write Medical Findings, I thought, you know what? I'm going to try Amazon again. Now, by this time, I'm now an Amazon author. So it was different people I dealt with, but they had my records. And it was interesting because having lived in the Middle East, I know what it's like to bargain. Because if you go into a market in the Middle East and people say, well, what's the price? And you know, I would have cousins visit me and say, what's the price? Somebody said, the price is what you agree to. And they look at me and says, what do you mean? I said, you negotiate. So I proposed this new book, Medical Findings, and the person there said, well, it'll cost this, that. I said, you know what? That's really too much. I have an alternative. I said, wait. Which is what happens in the Middle East, right? Wait. Don't walk out of the shop. They want to keep you in the shop. Have a cup of coffee. Sit down. So anyway, we arrived at a reasonable price with a very good contract in terms of royalties. And they laid out their parameters. And I said, fine. Now, in the meanwhile, I finally finished revising my very first book, which was old enough to feel better. So that was my first book, which already had 3 editions. So this was a 4th edition. And rather than doing it on my own, because I felt maybe I'm a little out of touch with everything that's going on in medicine, because I'm kind of focused now on special things, I made an agreement with one of my best trainees, who is now a family physician in the care of the elderly, who actually co-authored an article with me for Health Plexus, which is on there online, and she's a good writer. So I said, look, if you agree to do this with me, I will put you on the cover as an author. And she looked and said, really? That is marvelous, because I'm trying to move up the academic ladder and having a book with you. And anyway, so we did it. And I called it was a different person at Amazon, and he came up with a very, very good offer. And that book is, you know, they say impressed. It's in its final stages. We've gone over the manuscript. We've agreed on a cover. We had to go back and forth because I didn't like the first cover they did. They came up to the second cover. And now they're doing, which is the hard part, the index. And I told them it has to have an index, and they said, fine. So that's how I found my books. And I'm now telling authors, if you're a great writer, maybe you'll find a publisher that'll take you. It's not that they don't do it. Unless you have an agent, it's hard. But it's hard to get an agent. So the way publishers talk about it, they have what they call over-the-transom submissions, which means somebody sends in a book, like I did the first time. And if you look through, now you can do it online, and you see a list of publishers. Like if you go put in, say, Canadian publishers of fiction, Canadian publishers of memoirs, they will give you the parameters and they will say, we accept unsolicited manuscripts. Some will say, we only accept manuscripts from agents because they want somebody to filter. But if somebody wants to do a book and they have a small amount of money to invest in it, and they say, the first thing I want, I just want to get published. I'm not doing this to make money. I don't write books to make money. First of all, for my first book, Old Enough to Feel Better, I actually did make some money because it became almost a bestseller in Canada, which was 5,000 books. Well, I think I got 20% and it was $20. So that was $4 a book. So I don't know, $10,000 over 3 years. So now you don't make a living on that, but it was nice. Okay. The other books I make maybe $200 a year, $300, doesn't matter. All I know is when I go into the bank, because it's the newest money, and I deposit, they say, oh, $82. What's this for? I said, it's royalties for my book. And the teller, who I know, looks and says, your book? Isn't that wonderful? So that's how you find a publisher if you want to get published. But you may want to try going to a few full-service publishers beforehand. And I know somebody who's been rejected by a few. And I told her that maybe we should do it on Amazon. I'm trying to help.
So, Michael, when do you find the time to write with everything else that you do? And how long is the book writing process?
Well, right, for me, writing a book is, if you're a musician, and I don't remember, who in your family is a musician? Don't you have a musician?
My father, my aunt, yeah. My father, yep.
And I know a number of your friends because I've met them. Many. They're musicians.
Yes.
My wife is a musician. She's a wonderful pianist. My youngest son is a wonderful musician. If you're a musician, if you're in a symphony or in a orchestra, practicing is work, of course. But musicians will say it's wonderful work because I'm perfecting the playing of a piece of music that I love. I often say to people, when I do medicine, I feel like I'm a baseball player. Somebody's actually paying me to do what I love. Right? They're giving me money to practice medicine. I love it. I love writing. Writing to me is, it's fun. I mean, it lets me express things. I mean, I think if you are a writer, you're a writer. Like if you're a musician, you're a musician. I just spoke to just before I got on the interview today, spoke to my eldest daughter, who I said is an English professor, and she's a writer. And we talked about authors because we've often shared authors that we both like. And so the writing itself is not work. Now, if I'm not, Mordechai Richler once asked, because he was a very prolific Canadian writer. So they asked him about writing. He says, look, you have to think of writing as a job, right? You've got a project. Since you get up in the morning, say, I'm going to write from 8 to 12. I'll have my coffee. Maybe I'll have breakfast. Maybe I won't. 8 to 12. And for 8 to 12, I'm not doing anything else. I'm making it up because I don't remember the details. At 12 o'clock, I stop. I smoke a cigarette, whatever it is. You have to think of it. Now, I like to write in blocks when I have time. So some of my books I have written almost all during a vacation. I used to have a timeshare in Vermont, and in the latter years, nobody wanted to come with me. So I said, okay, I'll go on my own. And for a week, Brooklyn Beginnings, I did the revision, almost vacation. That was my project, and I enjoyed it. I had the mountains in front of me. I often listen to music while I'm writing because it helps me. So I find time to write. Fortunately, I'm semi-retired. I work part-time. I have this, I have that. But I write in little chunks, an hour. As long as I can have an hour, I can do something. An hour may be 5 pages. It may be an article. If it's a book, it's a section. So right now, I'm trying to upgrade my retirement book, and I'm doing that in sections. And I may ask the person who helped me with Old Enough to Feel Better to help me with this. We're meeting next week because I want to make sure the medical stuff is up to date, even though I'm pretty sure it is. But also, I want to give her the opportunity to be another co-author because she really enjoyed it.
Okay, maybe one day I'll be your co-author.
You know what?
As your biggest fan.
No, but the thing is, I need somebody who's a clinician now, because I want to make sure the medical stuff is up to date.
Yes, yes. No, we'll write on another topic.
Another topic for sure.
So give us some tips for any medical students or physicians who really want to write a book.
The first thing, I had a literary agent, a very well-known Canadian literary agent, I won't name her, but really well-known. And we were once talking, and she had helped me with my Old Enough to Feel Better. She placed it with Key Porter, which at that time was probably Canada's one of the premier presses. And we were talking, when she says, you know, people come up to me all of them, they say, I really have a book in me. And she'd say, well, that's good. Everybody has a book in them. Usually the first book is semi-autobiographical. So everybody thinks their life is interesting. And then people sometimes take their autobiography and turn it into a novel. The first book is semi-autobiographical. It's a novel. So she says, you have a book in you. And then she says, and she says it in Yiddish, do you have Sitzfleisch? For those listeners who don't know, Sitzfleisch is your backside. It means sitting flesh, your sitting flesh, your buttocks. Do you have Sitzfleisch? Because if you want to write and you don't have Sitzfleisch, you're not going to be an author. You have to be able to sit down and write. And that's it. So I tell people, start off with something digestible. Write a short story. Write an article. Just write. See what it's like, the process of writing. Because it's a process. It's like, I mean, it's not just a creative, I got an inspiration and I write. It's a creative process. If you're going to write a novel, there's homework. What's the novel about? And like everything, I'm now listening to a lecture series on the English novel, because I love, you know, and the person is talking about the evolution of the English novel, right? And what made the English novel was this new sort of structure, and every novel had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And depending on the period of time, the end had to be what they called a comedic end, which means a happy ending. Now, for those who've read 19th century English literature, Jane Austen, you know, everybody has, and if you've seen the films out, they all end up after this and that and this and semi-tragedy with a happy ending. If you read Russian literature, again, you know that there's no such tragic thing as a happy ending.
All
there's
tragic.
No such thing as a happy. It's all tragic. Nothing like a good, you read Crime and Punishment, you say, what could be happy about that ending, right? But, you know, it's a different sort of approach to writing. And, you know, if you want to write, you have to decide, what is it that I have to give to people? Why should somebody read this book? It's either entertaining, it's educational, it's engaging. I mean, if you read Agatha Christie, and there was a period where I was really having trouble reading. And I spoke to my English professor daughter and said, what should I do? She said, read mysteries, because mysteries are very satisfying. And if you really want to read nice, satisfying mysteries, read Agatha Christie, because they're easy to read. And the thing is, within the story is the clue. So if you read the story carefully, the clue is there. But if you don't, when you get the answer, you say, aha, that's the clue. So I did that and I read half a dozen. And I thought, this person is marvelous, because each one of them was engaging. So that's one genre. And I think, you know, anybody who likes to write, the answer is sit down and write. And if you can't get it published, okay. But the chances are, and you can get it published somewhere. Like there are a couple of journals that do narratives. They publish narratives. I've had a few articles published there. One's called Intima. I can't remember what the other one is called, Journal of Narrative Medicine. And they're stories. They're not necessarily clinical, in the sense of, you know, a clinical case and how you solved it. But I remember I wrote one called The Story of My Stethoscope. I mean, it was a story related to my stethoscope. My stethoscope as I diagnosed heart failure, but how I ended up with my stethoscope and the story of it as it evolved and deteriorated and got resurrected to say. So that's it.
So please tell our listeners where they can get a copy of Medical Findings as well as some of your other books.
Well, all of my books are listed in the main online, that's Amazon, Indigo, Chapters. If you go in, they don't have them on the shelf, you know. I used to go and get very upset if I didn't find my book on the shelf. And every now and then I did. I said, oh, one copy. But most people don't do it that way. If you go to Indigo and you want a book, you look online, they'll say it'll be here in 2 days. The person who I spoke to yesterday who had a copy of my book, she said she ordered it the day before in anticipation of our meeting, and she wanted to have a chance to read a few chapters before we met. And, you know, I mean, whether you like doing it online or you like going into bookshops, I love bookshops because I love to, you know, to browse. There's lots of places to get books. In the States, Barnes & Noble usually carries most of the books. I don't even know who's in existence anymore. You know, a lot of bookshops come and go. And I mean, I don't know what's happened to Indigo. Have they not sort of combined with somebody or?
I think so. But there are some physical locations.
Yeah, yeah, no, the ship, the book, I don't just don't know who is Heather.
Of course, I will definitely link all of the books. Yes. The podcast, the new book, as well as yep. Your older
book. Well, if you link my website,
yes,
drmichaelgordon.ca, my webmaster, I just sent it to her. I just looked this morning. She listed my new book on it and the link to Amazon.
Very good. So what's next in line for your book writing?
Well, I'm trying to finish my retirement book. And after that, I may take a break. Because it's hard, you know, I mean, you do it and then you take a breath and then I sort of stick to articles. I'm doing a lot of articles because there are all kinds of things to write about in articles. And they're very different. They're short, they're to the point. Some of them are clinical. Some of them are, you know, socio. I write quite a lot on ethics and I've had a number of articles published in the Canadian Journal of Bioethics, which is a very nice ethics journal. So yeah, there's always something to write.
Well, Michael, I love that you never stop. Please keep writing. Please keep telling stories and we're going to keep enjoying.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. This is a long, wonderful tradition because I can't even remember when I started working with you and Mark at Health Plexus. Is it what, 15 years? How long ago is it that we started?
Oh, yeah, maybe 12.
Yeah, yeah. I remember. And I'll tell you, I'm assuming that people are listening to this know the platform. The evolution of your platform is absolutely amazing. It is amazing. I mean, for continuing education, it has visuals. I mean, it really is something else. And I refer a lot of people to it, you know, for the modules. So
we also won't stop then. We will also continue improving.
Yes, yes.
Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please like, share, send us your comments. And until next time, stay curious.